Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Kun lapsi syntyy, syntyy myös vanhempi. Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka, kolmen lapsen äiti, ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
Hi, I'm Salima Shivji, and I'm a reporter here in Mumbai. We're gearing up for the biggest election in history right now, with Prime Minister Narendra Modi looking very likely to win his third term. And whether you love him, hate him, or know nothing about him, there's no denying Modi is one of the most powerful political figures out there right now. Learn why in the newest season of Understood. Modi's India Understood, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 18th of May, these are our main stories. Israel says its forces in Gaza have recovered the bodies of three Israelis abducted from a music festival during the Hamas attacks last October. Gunmen in Afghanistan have killed three foreign nationals and an Afghan in the city of Bamyan. And President Zelensky of Ukraine has signed new laws to try to boost army recruitment in the face of growing military pressure from Russia. Also in this podcast, a crisis in Cuba's sugar industry and its knock-on effects.
It's a disaster. Today, the sugar industry in Cuba almost doesn't exist. Was the locomotive for the rest of the economy for more than 150 years.
When Hamas attacked Israel 7 months ago, about 1,200 people were killed. A further 252 were taken back to Gaza as hostages. Now Israel says its military forces have retrieved the bodies of three of the people who were at the Nova Music Festival on October the 7th. Daniel Hagari is spokesman for the IDF.
According to the credible information that we have gathered, Shani Luk, Amit Buskila and Yitzhak Lerenter were murdered by Hamas while escaping the Nova Music Festival on October 7th, and their bodies were taken into Gaza. They were celebrating life in the Nova Music Festival, and they were murdered by Hamas.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams, told us more.
The Israeli military has not released details on where and how the three bodies were found. But Daniel Hagari said that there was credible information that all three had been murdered by Hamas during the awful events that surrounded the Nova Music Festival on October the 7th. Now, we already knew that Shani Luk had been confirmed dead, indeed, at the end of October, after a piece of her skull was identified and it was determined that she could not possibly have survived. But the other two hostages, Amit Buskila and Yitzhak Gelenter, it was hoped that both of those two were still alive. And I think, you know, this just goes to the heart of the agony that the families of the hostages have been going through the past 7 months, not knowing from one day to the next whether their loved ones are alive and just clinging to the hope that they are. And this also highlights, of course, that the longer this goes on, as some of the hostage families have been saying, and they've taken their message to the streets of Israel, that the bleaker the chances of their loved ones surviving become.
And what sort of reaction has there been within Israel to the news that these three bodies have been recovered?
Well, we've had a statement from the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, saying that the loss was heartbreaking. And he said that we will return all our hostages, both the living and the dead. I mean, I think this will be an evening. It's the Sabbath. The news came after the start of the Sabbath, so everyone's kind of gone home for the weekend. This will cast a very heavy shadow over the weekend. And, you know, I think you can expect the whole country to feel pretty somber about this, you know, even as the war grinds on.
That was Paul Adams in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the Israeli military says it has engaged in intense fighting in the Jabalia area of northern Gaza, which it had previously claimed was mostly cleared of Hamas fighters. Tanks supported by fighter jets and drones are said to be confronting Hamas both above ground and in tunnels, with fierce battles taking place deep inside the Jabalia refugee camp. The army claims to have killed more than 200 gunmen. There has also been continued fighting in and around Rafah City in the far south of Gaza, where thousands of civilians are continuing to flee. Three Spanish tourists and an Afghan citizen have been killed in a gun attack in the city of Bamiyan in central Afghanistan. Several other people, including foreign citizens, were reportedly wounded when two gunmen opened fire on a vehicle in the city's central market. From Afghanistan, here's Caroline Davis.
Early reports of the attack were confirmed by a spokesperson for the Taliban government on Friday night. In a statement, he said that the shooting was against the public and that there were further foreigners and Afghans also injured in the incident. Security forces are currently trying to find the killers, and four people have been arrested. One eyewitness told the BBC that the attackers were two people in a car. Images of the scene show several bodies lying in the street.
Caroline Davis. President Zelensky has signed two new laws to boost army recruitment as Ukraine struggles to mobilise fighters. Some prisoners will be allowed to join the military, and fines have gone up for men ignoring the order to fight. From Saturday, all men between 18 and 60 will have to update their details using a new Defence Ministry app. Zhanna Bespiachuk reports from Kyiv.
Ukraine's long-anticipated mobilisation law won't change anything for those who have been fighting for over 2 years with little break or chance to see their families. This law doesn't allow them to leave the army until the end of the war. However, the Ukrainian authorities hope that it will allow them to boost mobilization and help those on the front line by lowering the minimum conscription age to 25 and by increasing fines for draft evasion.
For almost a week now, Russian troops have been engaged in fierce fighting in the Kharkiv region of Ukraine. President Putin says the aim is to create what he's calling a buffer zone to protect Russian border regions. The Russians have already captured a number of villages and are threatening to take the town of Vovchansk. But for now, President Putin says he has no plans to capture the city of Kharkiv. He made his comments at the end of his state visit to China.
As for what is happening on the Kharkiv axis, it is also the Ukrainians' fault, because they shelled and unfortunately continue shelling residential areas of border territories, including Belgorod. They fire directly at the center of the town, directly at the residential areas. And I said publicly, if it continues, we will have to create a safety zone, a buffer zone. As for capturing Kharkiv, we currently have no such plans.
So the fighting in the Kharkiv region of Ukraine continues. Our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale, has sent this report from the front line.
We're driving at speed towards the village of Lipsy, now under siege.
We're just passing destroyed villages. This was from the last time Russia occupied this area, threatening to do the same again. And we are driving forward to a Ukrainian National Guard position where they're operating their drones, trying to destroy Russian targets, trying to stop their advance. And as soon as you get out,
let's follow him.
Good. Just being told to follow.
We run past a smouldering blaze. The Russians have recently fired Grad rockets near their position.
Just walking into the bunker where they clearly got their control room for the drones. A few soldiers looking at a drone feed. Hello.
Just a week ago, Andriy and his men were fighting further east. But now they've been charged with halting the Russians advancing Kharkiv.
The situation is dynamic, tense. It is hard to predict anything.
I understand why they want to pull our forces from defense lines in Donetsk and Luhansk regions. It was just a question of time. The Russians always use mean tactics.
As we talk, they spot more Russian troops on the move.
Right now, we can't show you this picture, but our pilot has just found out the movement of the enemy group to our positions.
There's a concern. They're about to be attacked.
This is where they're directing artillery fire. They're telling us to get out. They've said this area is under threat, and we're going to go.
Further from the front, at a field hospital, Victor is the latest Ukrainian casualty of this latest Russian assault. He's lost some fingers in a mortar explosion. The Russians, too, are taking heavy casualties. But Victor says they are many.
Our guys are constantly fighting off attacks. Sabotage and reconnaissance groups come there all the time. There are a lot of them there.
They're not just outnumbered, they're also outgunned.
They have everything, whatever they want, and we have nothing to fight with, but we do what we can.
That's outgoing. Just arrived at the artillery position.
At a Ukrainian artillery position outside the town of Volchansk, they're clearing out used shells from their Russian-made self-propelled gun, waiting for the arrival of more. They soon come in a small van. This unit, too, has been redirected from another part of the front, stretching and thinning their defences. Reinforcements are making a difference, but at what cost elsewhere? And Mikhailo, the artillery commander, wonders if this could have been avoided.
We could have built some kind of fortification and lost less human lives, fewer villages. Now we'll have to fight it all back. We'll now need to use more resources. We could have used logs and concrete. Now we'll have to use shells and people to take this land back.
1 year ago, Ukraine hoped it would be taking back its land in an offensive. Now, it's simply hoping it can hold the line.
A man who broke into the California home of Nancy Pelosi nearly 2 years ago and attacked her husband Paul with a hammer has been sentenced to 30 years in prison. Ms. Pelosi was Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives at the time. Nomia Iqbal reports.
David DePapp broke into the Pelosi's home in October 2022. During his trial, he took to the stand in his own defense and admitted to it. Jurors heard how DePapp had been driven by far-right conspiracy theories and had initially planned to target Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat who at the time was second in line to the presidency. She wasn't at home the night of the attack. In a letter to the judge ahead of sentencing, Paul Pelosi said his skull fractures and injuries have continued to affect him.
Nomia Iqbal. Cubans are enduring some of their bleakest economic times since the Cold War, amid worsening inflation, a scarcity of basic goods, and the decades-long U.S. economic embargo. In an unexpected move, the country's economy minister, Alejandro Gil Fernandez, was arrested in March for corruption. But many think it will take more than one ministerial casualty to pull Cuba from its economic woes. Our correspondent Will Grant travelled to the heartland of one of Cuba's most quintessential industries, sugar, to see how tough the situation has become.
The men of the Yumuri Sugar Union have worked the cane fields around Cienfuegos since they were old enough to wield a machete. It's tough, thankless work with aging Soviet-era technology, made harder by decades of US sanctions. Sugar is part of the island's DNA. But as this year's sugarcane harvest draws down, the industry is facing near total collapse. There's not enough trucks, and the fuel shortages mean sometimes we can't work for days, says cane cutter Miguel Guzman. As inflation and scarcity worsen, Miguel's low wages barely buy him anything anymore. Ciudad Caracas, a 19th century sugar mill near Cienfuegos, is humid and noisy, its air thick with the overpowering smell of molasses. Running on rusting, obsolete technology, it is one of only two dozen working mills on the island. Cuba must now import sugar to meet domestic demand. Once unthinkable, and a far cry from the glory days when Cuban sugar was the envy of the Caribbean and exported around the world. The problems in sugar aren't only the fault of the US embargo. Years of chronic mismanagement and underinvestment have also wrecked the once thriving industry. Today, sugar receives less than 3% of state investment, as the Cuban government has backed tourism as its key economic motor instead.
It's a disaster. Today, the sugar industry in Cuba almost doesn't exist.
Juan Triana is from the Center for Studies of the Cuban Economy in Havana. He says the issues with sugar are affecting other important industries in Cuba, like its rum trade.
This industry had really a very important role in Cuban economy, was the locomotive for the rest of the economy for more than 150 years. And we lose something like that.
One man who can get his hands on enough sugar is Martin Nisarane. Part of a new breed of Cuban private entrepreneurs, his company produces yogurt and ice cream. As he shows me around the factory outside Havana, he says he hopes to double production soon. The business has been hailed by the Cuban president as a model for the future. It may still be a dirty word for the Cuban state, but this is capitalism. Pure and simple, no matter how much the businessmen behind it display their revolutionary credentials. I put it to him that only people with close links to the Cuban Communist Party are able to start a private business as sophisticated as his.
I'm not an employee of the Cuban state. I'm a non-state means of production. The state treats me like just another private entrepreneur with no special privileges whatsoever.
None of this bodes well for Cuban sugar or its long-suffering workers. There's a saying in Cuba, without sugar, there's no country. Already, its sugar processing plants are barely operational. Cuba's once important and profitable trade is now a ghost industry.
Will Grant in Cuba. Still to come.
You go from the very sort of private, personal moments to the most official possible moment, such as the coronation.
An exhibition of royal portraits illustrating the power of photography over the last century.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
Hi, I'm Salima Shivji, and I'm a reporter here in Mumbai. We're gearing up for the biggest election in history right now, with Prime Minister Narendra Modi looking very likely to win his third term. And whether you love him, hate him, or know nothing about him, there's no denying Modi is one of the most powerful political figures out there right now. Learn why in the newest season of Understood. Modi's India Understood, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
A mass wedding was due to take place in Nigeria next week, involving 100 girls and young women. Many are orphans whose parents were killed by kidnapping gangs that roam northern Nigeria. Such ceremonies are not uncommon, but have sparked outrage in the West African nation over concerns that some of the girls might be underage. A human rights group, Concerned Nigerian Citizens, has launched a petition to try to stop the practice. John Donison spoke to Uju Kennedy Ohanenye, Nigeria's Minister of Women's Affairs, who's prompted an investigation into the circumstances surrounding the ceremony.
Since I came in as a minister, I'm not aware of mass marriage not being common in Nigeria. The only thing I am aware is that being a Minister of Women Affairs is my duty to protect the women and the children. And when you tamper with the mother hen's chicks, the mother hen will react. I had to stop it because we have rights for these young girls in Nigeria. If it has been happening before, I'm not aware. That was why this one shocked me and I had to do what I had to do.
How young are some of these girls?
That's the investigation I want to carry out. I've not carried out the investigation yet. I just got an injunction to make sure the wedding does not hold until such a time we clarify things and even check on their consent, their ages and all that. So I'm yet to do that. But because of time frame, I had to get the injunction first. But as it is, we've made peace between myself, the speaker, and the emir of Katangora, because they said they don't want to quarrel with me. I'm their sister. They don't want to fight with me. They have cancelled the wedding, but I'm still holding on to my injunction. The matter will still remain until after the date of the wedding. Then I will be sure that everything is okay. Then we'll take it from there.
Have you been able to be in touch with any of the girls and young women?
We are in touch with them, and the most important thing is from Monday, a bank is going there to open an account for them. I want to take care of them, empower them, take them to school, sponsor this school from the Minister of Women Affairs, and make sure they are more relaxed and more comfortable. I want them to breathe fresh air. So when I do that, I'm going to prove it by Monday, and I will onboard them on our portal, where they will start receiving help from the government. As I've partnered with the speaker, he is equally going to join in making sure those girls get empowerment.
Uju Kennedy Ohanenye, Nigeria's Minister of Women Affairs. Next to India, a spice trade group has said that spice exports could drop by 40% after two major brands in the country were hit with contamination allegations over the use of a pesticide. The organisation considers the chemical safe, but others say it allegedly causes cancer in the event of long-term exposure. The Federation of Indian Spice Stakeholders said the industry has already seen buyers put some export orders on hold amid international scrutiny of two popular Indian brands, MDH and Everest. Both companies say their products are safe for consumption. India is the world's biggest exporter, consumer and producer of spices. James Reynolds spoke to our South Asia regional editor Ambarasa Natarajan and asked him for more on the key worries.
This has caused concern not only within India, which is the largest spice consumer in the world, but also in countries around the globe, because Indian spices are being exported to various countries from China, Bangladesh, Nepal, USA, to various parts of Europe and Australia as well, because you also have Indian communities living in faraway places. Now, what Hong Kong authorities and also in Singapore authorities were saying was that they found these cancer-causing pesticide, ethylene oxide, in four of these brands. In fact, Hong Kong withdrew four of these curry powders from its shops, and Singapore, one particular product was withdrawn. Now, this triggered alarm across the world, and then the U.S. Food and Drug Administration agency, they say they are now investigating. So this is a causing concern not only for the consumers, but also for those who are exporting and producing. It has also raised lots of questions about what kind of regulatory mechanism, what kind of inspections the Indian authorities do before these spices are exported to various countries.
What's been India's response?
Now, the Indian government has already ordered the various state agencies to inspect all these factories where they manufacture, and also the samples given by various companies for exports. So they want to get to the bottom of it, because this market is about $4 billion exports to outside India, and also $10 billion within the country. And now the traders are worried, exporters are worried, if China or other countries take action, that could take a big hit on the export potential. That means potential loss of revenue and loss of jobs. That is a big concern. On the other hand, what the environmentalists and activists are pointing out is that Indian government should strengthen its regulatory and inspection mechanisms, and the whole approach towards food safety needs to change. How come this particular pesticide was allowed to be found in two brands? But even though these two companies strongly deny, then they say that their products are safe for human consumption. But this is also causing concern among the authorities, because they need to get to the bottom of it to prevent any cascading effect.
Ambarasan Natarajan. The President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, has criticised what he said were manifest failures by the British and Irish governments to investigate the bombings in Dublin and Monaghan in the 1970s. 33 people were killed, two of them pregnant women. It's also reported that the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair had discussed the matter and what intelligence agencies knew with a former Irish counterpart. A ceremony was held in Dublin on Friday to mark the 50th anniversary of the attacks. Our Europe regional editor Paul Moss has this report.
It was the most deadly attack during Northern Ireland's long conflict, but it happened in the Irish Republic. Three bombs went off in Dublin and one in the town of Monaghan on May 17, 1974. The Loyalist paramilitary group, the UVF, eventually said it was behind the explosions, but nobody was ever convicted. And there have been long-running allegations that elements within the British state colluded in the attack, or at least obstructed the investigation. The Irish president, Michael Higgins, laid a wreath at a memorial to those who were killed, addressing survivors and relatives of the dead.
It is yourselves and your families who have had to bear the grief of those tragic events, and added to it, have had to bear the long wait for information on those tragic events that was and is your right.
Today's ceremony was also attended by Ireland's former Prime Minister, Bertie Ahern. He said Tony Blair had once told him that MI5 and MI6 probably had information about the bombings, but that they wouldn't release it. Mr. Ahern, too, called for all relevant documents now to be handed over. In fact, the UVF gang thought to be responsible for the bombings is currently being looked at as part of a wider police inquiry into historic crimes committed during the Troubles. Their report is due to be published by the end of this year.
Paul Moss. The Iranian Football Federation has ruled that only female fans will be allowed into football matches between two local men's teams next season. The unprecedented move follows abuse of some female spectators at a recent match between the sides. Here's Mike Thompson.
Until recently, Iranian women were banned from football stadiums, with only a handful of special exceptions. Now, Iranian male supporters of two men's teams, Sepahan and Persepolis, are getting the same treatment after some female fans suffered verbal abuse. Next season, only women will be allowed to watch the sides play each other. Iranian media described the move as a significant shift in the status of women in Iranian society. But as arrests of those breaching the country's strict headscarf rule continue, many may feel there's a very long way to go yet.
Mike Thompson. It's been a big week for British royal portraits. A big red painting of King Charles was unveiled on Tuesday. I will share it on social media if you haven't seen it. Then on Friday in central London, an exhibition of photographic portraits of the royal family opened, alongside some previously unseen images of the royal family. It's a reminder of the power of photography over the last century to define how we see and understand this institution. And it tells a tale of a changing monarchy, adapting to the fashions and mores of the decades. Our royal correspondent Johnny Diamond went to the King's Gallery next to Buckingham Palace to take a look. He asked the curator Alessandro Nassini to highlight a few portraits that tell the story of the exhibition.
The exhibition charts the evolution of royal portrait photography over the past century. And we are here in the first room in the exhibition. On my right is the engagement portrait of Prince Albert and Lady Elizabeth Bowes-Lyon, who will become King George VI and Queen Elizabeth. It was produced in 1923 by a photographer called Emile Hoppe. This is a monochrome photograph. Several portraits were taken and some were released to the press, but this particular one was never released, so it was kept for private use and shared only between family and friends.
They're both looking at the camera, and although it's relatively formal, they're close to each other, aren't they? This is a pretty intimate picture.
Exactly, and in fact, the photographs which were released at the time, they were quite far apart.
Yeah. And to our right, something that feels very different.
Yes, we have the official coronation portrait of King Charles III, which was taken by Hugo Bernard only over a year ago, on 6th of May 2023. And of course, it's an official portrait. So in this room, we have some elements contrasting with each other. You go from the very sort of private, personal moments to the most official possible moment, such as the coronation.
And in the coronation photograph, the king is holding in one hand the orb, in the other hand the sceptre. There are these great flowing robes of purple and ermine, and on top of him this astonishing crown as well. He is almost a prop for the ornaments of state.
in a portrait, an official portrait like this, you need to embrace the theatricality, perhaps, of the coronation. All those elements are to be present, and the tradition of a coronation portrait has to be respected, but also a certain element of innovation, perhaps the way the king is sitting, which is perhaps not traditional in a way.
So a little more informal.
He's tried to be, I suppose, more relatable. He wants to show his king, you know, everybody. And I might take you actually to the next photograph, which perhaps we can express that a bit more.
Let's go.
I mean, I love this photograph. I always loved it.
This is Cecil Beaton's portrait of Queen Elizabeth II from 1968. She's against a very plain, light backdrop, wearing this long, dark cape fixed at the neck with a chain. But she's not staring directly at the camera.
Yes, she is a very solitary figure, and she is not depicted with any traditional
regalia,
such as tiaras or insignia or very important jewellery. I think Beaton really captures the fact that that's the woman behind the responsibility of the crown. I think it's very human as a portrait. And every time I look at it, I always think of what Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, wrote to Beaton only 5 years earlier, in 1963. As a family, we must be deeply grateful to you for producing us as really quite nice and real people.
That gap between the public perception and the private reality.
Absolutely. I think it's what something that I hope comes through this exhibition is exactly that. This range from the fully private and personal to the fully official.
Yes.
Is that, you know, just showing different facets of people with this unique role.
That report by Johnny Diamond, and you can see some of the photographs on the BBC News website. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Stephen Bailey. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
Kun lapsi syntyy, syntyy myös vanhempi. Liberon odotushuone podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka, 3 lapsen äiti, ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
Hi, I'm Salima Shivji, and I'm a reporter here in Mumbai. We're gearing up for the biggest election in history right now, with Prime Minister Narendra Modi looking very likely to win his third term. And whether you love him, hate him, or know nothing about him, there's no denying Modi is one of the most powerful political figures out there right now. Learn why in the newest season of Understood. Modi's India Understood, available now wherever you get your podcasts.